Okay, this is session number 18, side one, September 25th, 2006. Here with Scott, and we're still doing the McLuhan thread, the right-hand side of my book, Fatty Communion with Bob Dobbs, and we just did the last session, number 17. We did a lot of ESP, a lot of different quotes around the words or acronym ESP. Then we did a quote. We started to move into a new section of what I've organized here, and the previous quote was from Understanding Media, page 173 of the original paperback edition, Signet. I think it's called Signet paperback, not the MIT edition, which came out in 1994. And so just to get into the theme, the quote is, "If there is indeed a terrible nihilism in the photo and a substitution of shadows for substance, then we are surely not the worse for knowing it. The technology of the photo is an extension of our own being and can be withdrawn from circulation like any other technology if we decide that it is virulent. But amputation of such extensions," and extensions is italicized, "but amputation of such extensions of our physical being calls for as much knowledge and skill as are prerequisite to any other physical amputation." So these quotes are going to go into the idea of media ecology and withdrawing media, putting them back into the society to see the effects and to take advantage of known effects. The next quote from Understanding Media is page 37. It says, you want to read it, Scott?
All right. "Is this fragmentation that enables him," referring to Western man, "to ignore cause and effect in all interplay of technology and culture. It is quite different in big business. There, tribal man is on the alert for stray seeds of change."
Okay, this is interesting. This is the first principle of media ecology. One of the first is to understand that Western man, because he has exaggerated his visual space through print, during the Gutenberg era, he thinks there is a separation between him and his environment. So it doesn't occur to Western man in general that media affect him or affect society and that they affect other media. He is just goal-oriented, he or she is goal-oriented towards more and more technology, filling in the empty void of visual space. Visual space creates a kind of void. It's in isolation from other sensory interplay. So the book and its effect is, when it's printed, is what you have with the colonization of North and South America and Africa by a culture that's made visually extreme, visual space extreme, so that it acts in isolation. It's not interested in the effects of things or the reaction. It wants to impose its sense on the whole world. And it wants to fill up its space and its sense of the space with its sense of what the space should be filled up with, based on the visual bias. So that leads to a great indifference to other cultures. And that explains the murders of the native populations in North and South America, 500 years ago.
Mm-hmm.
You know, there's just no sense of give and take. It's just all one way. The visual spaceman has a mandate to impose the effect of print on everybody. And everybody assumes that's a religious mandate. But it's only a religious mandate for those cultures that their religion, whose religion, is found the effect of the phonetic alphabet. Mm-hmm. And then enhanced by the printing press.
Yeah, it's kind of interesting because it shows, well, ordinarily we look at the polarity between religions. If we look at religions that are based in visual space, it actually shows the underlying commonality.
Yeah.
And maybe shows why they're both equally dysfunctional for the same reasons.
Yeah, and the Middle East shows that. You've got the three monotheistic religions fighting it out over the area where visual space in some sense began, with the Phoenician alphabet, and then the Hebrew alphabet, and then the Greek alphabet. You know, that is the writing in general came out of Mesopotamia, they say, but the phonetic alphabet in particular comes out of an area near there. So that's where you're seeing visual space rip its colleagues apart right now.
Is it called the phonetic alphabet because the Phoenicians had something to do with the evolution of the alphabet?
No, it comes from the word phonemes.
Oh.
I don't know if the word phonemes comes from Phoenix or Phoenician. I'm not sure. It may come from P-H-O, which might be the same thing that Phoenician comes from.
Right.
I'm not sure. You have morphemes and phonemes.
And oddly enough, the English is not even really phonetic. Phonetic is, it sounds like it's spelled out. And, of course, English, and probably true of other languages, there are all these weird rules and extra letters. And
right, well, that's the, English was a great oral tactile culture. I mean, McLuhan used to point out that rock and roll only did well in the 1560s in English, because English was measured in feet, or what's called iambic pentameter. So it had a kinetic tactile quality and made it, you know.
What do you mean it's measured in feet?
Yeah, you know, when you measure prose or poetry, it was called iambic pentameter.
Yeah.
And so he's making a pun on feet. It's measured in feet, so it's the music for dancing.
Measured in feet, as opposed to what, metric?
Not numerical feet. It's a term for in grammar.
Oh.
And the beats are measured in feet, and it's called iambic pentameter.
Oh, okay.
So anyways, the feet aspect of English made it totally resonant with the rhythms of rock itself, electrified music. So that is why rock could not be done in other languages and be successful. Mm-hmm. So most cultures in the 50s, 60s who got into electric rock and roll, they would sing in English.
But all dancing involves footwork.
Yes. So your point?
Well, I don't know. I thought he was making it.
You know, classical music split off speech, song, and the instrument.
Mm-hmm.
So rock and roll brings them back. And so that's dancing with vocals. So the vocal should resonate with the electric effect.
Mm-hmm.
It's almost like saying dancing is kinetic space as the content of electric tactility. And since America was, McLuhan used to point out, the hyperkinetic culture, one of its main art forms was its dances, and the series and sequence of evolution of dance in the United States.
Well, jazz brought in that kind of, you know, you were already dancing apart by the time the hot jazz came in.
Yeah, that's the era of the telegraph.
Yeah.
That's when you're starting to get electrified, and that's when,
But still, in jazz, there was a lot of swing. You were dancing, you were kind of swinging around.
You got to go to New Orleans. There's jazz.
Yeah.
That's before swing.
It's probably not until you get to rock where there's absolutely no touching. People are just hopping around.
Well, that's the resonant interval. That's the TV. You have connection in the radio era. That's the jitterbug and all that stuff, the swing dancing.
Yeah.
But then the total tactile act of television in the satellite environment broke up dancing.
Yeah.
Broke up holding on. You then created what McLuhan used to say, it was an expression of satellite. You started to create your own space.
Oh.
And communicate with body language.
Yeah.
So, but, you know, jazz, it started, in a way, in New Orleans, like 150 years ago. There was a square in the center of New Orleans, and the Africans would come in to that square and spend all day dancing. And it looked pretty weird to the white people, you know, and dance like that. So I think I saw this in Ken Burns' documentary, History of Jazz, and they had photos of the place. And that was like the beginning of this group dancing that then led into early club music, brothel music, culture music. And then some of the blacks got relative liberation in the... So they got the instruments from the military. They were bringing their trumpets and used those instruments to start jamming. That's how they got into the, you know, horn part of, the brass part of jazz.
Mm-hmm.
That's at, you know, 1890s, 1900. Then they moved north, and then the industrial environment of the north changed them. And then you started getting into ragtime, which actually I think came from when they moved to the Midwest. But you have this evolution of the blacks moving out at the end of the 19th century and encounter in different parts of the United States, and the music change, the music they bring with them changes.
Mm-hmm.
And then the radio comes in, and they really take off.
Mm.
That's what we call jazz, right? The big band stuff. So the point
is... So how do we account for square dancing?
That's for squares. That's the white people.
Uh-huh.
It's country music, right? Rural.
Country, yeah. I don't know. I guess that probably was even before radio. I don't know.
Yeah, they probably had the hootenannies in the 19th century, though I'm not sure. It might have been a product of radio, you know, whatever, the old Opry stuff, you know.
Mm-hmm.
So the point is America is hyperkinetic, and as the electric age, 20th century, comes in, it really becomes a dancing culture, and all kinds of dances evolve. Rapid change of styles.
Mm-hmm.
And you can look at the kind of styles mashed up with the media, so that the cakewalk is like the movie era, jitterbugging is the jazz or swing era, and then jiving in the 50s with black and white TV, and then satellite environment in the early 60s, you have the twist, and then the watusi, and people start dancing without holding hands.
Mm-hmm.
You know what I mean? Creating known spaces.
Mm.
And then they stopped dancing in the psychedelic phase and just got stoned and danced in their minds.
You have people whirling around with making flowing hand gestures. And
yeah, that was one aspect, while the others just lay down and sort of explored proprioceptively their space, the sound hallucinations they were creating.
Yeah.
And then that flipped into the disco, which was everybody dancing around the satellite ball.
Yeah, what was the change that went from... I mean, we were just moving from the 70s?
Disco's at 75, peaks in 77, 78, 79, at Studio 54.
So what happened just around 75 that caused us to flip into disco?
The instant replay and the beginning of the digital Android meme, the shrinking of major media, and the shrinking of the satellite. And so what is the image of the club and the disco? It's the disco ball, which is like a glittering mirrored satellite. And it's shrunk down to be a tiny object, and everybody's dancing around it.
Wow, that's interesting. And before that, it was surrounding us.
But beg your pardon?
Before that, the satellite environment was surrounding us.
Yeah, it was huge in the 60s.
And we were inside of it, and then it shrunk down to the disco ball.
Yeah.
That's cool.
Yeah. I've been saying that for years. That usually communicates that.
Yeah, I know. I've heard you say it before, but I never really got it.
Yeah, because in the 60s, the satellite effect is you're making your own space. You're floating over the major media, right?
Uh-huh.
So that's the people standing up and waving, doing their own playing kind of hallucinatory gesturing kind of dance by themselves, like off in a drug-spaced mind, right?
Mm-hmm.
But then there's the sit-down era. You know, the Quaaludes era, everybody's on drugs and just listening to, what are those bands? Yes, and those kind of bands,
mm-hmm.
before punk. And then the satellite environment that everybody was responding to drops out and gets shrunk, and it turns into an art form. And then you have the other aspect of the digital speed up is punk music.
Is that parallel with disco? That's after disco?
Yeah, exactly
or?
The same period.
Oh.
I mean, basically, the myth of CBGBs and punk is that the certain bohemian, you know, village artists, that generation coming in, late baby boomers, they were reacting to the disco fad. They didn't want to go for that glitzy velvet rope elitist kind of culture, so they slummed it and went downtown and created their own music. Totally contrary to disco.
Well, the disco was kind of techno, wasn't it? I mean, it involved using sampling and stuff like that, right? There was
sort
just no computer.
Early. Yeah, it
but,
started.
But the punk didn't. It was just three guys just going as fast as they could.
Well, yeah, it was Luddite, in a sense. Neo-Luddite. It went back to doing more with less, which is another aspect. See, the common ground is they're both responding to the digital effect. One is to dance around the old satellite environment, and the other is to do more with less. Use three chords and to make a fast song.
Mm-hmm.
And no more of this, you know, yes, whatever those bands were that were doing those long...
Right. Don't forget Rush. They were up in your neck of the woods.
Yeah, were they? They didn't long stuff, did they? I don't know that.
Oh,
Did they do long solos?
Not necessarily.
Right. They're in between.
I mean, if you want to go back to the long stuff, like the first thing that comes to mind is like Inagata Davita, like this unbelievable 30-minute rendition of, you know, or the long version of Light My Fire, but that was earlier than that.
Yeah, that was Iron Butterfly, late 67, 68, but by early 70s, you're having the guitar heroes. The Eric Clapton's, Jeff Beck's, and they may not have been there right then, but the...
We had guitar heroes in the 60s. Clapton was making it
in the 60s.
They
just were saying, they're successors. Eric Clapton comes back with Layla in 74, 75, but in the, you see, the bands that come in 71, 72, 73, what Zappa called the Quaalude period, and even Zappa started to stretch out a little more and feature his guitar playing. But there was these long guitar stuff going on in these bands after Eric Clapton.
Mm-hmm.
Genesis was another one, I think.
Yeah, the first band was Cream, and I don't think they had any cuts over 4 minutes.
Right, but they were... they were instrumental or something, intriguing about them. I don't know if they did long.
They did some long, like on the Good Bike. They did some long stuff. But,
yeah.
Yeah.
They definitely weren't. They were FM. You know, they were not doing
the stuff. They got airplay short because it was commercially driven, and they had to get the commercials in.
Yeah, they kind of broke up just before FM took over, and it was FM that allowed the extended album.
Yeah.
Album rock came in.
Well, the big news I heard as I was passing by the TV today is Howard Stern launched XM radio, and now there's some other new radio frequency that's starting up, and Oprah Winfrey is going to be, they're saying, you know, Howard's got competition because Oprah Winfrey's starting her own radio frequency.
At the same time, I guess.
Yeah. That's pretty trippy when you think about it. I mean, one artist gets big enough, goes off and just, you know, launches his own radio frequency, you know, a whole other band that's, you know, satellite frequency, a whole channel to themselves, practically.
You mean he's left Sirius?
No. I realize that Sirius has, I guess, a lot of stations. I've never listened to it, but I think Howard Stern's probably put him on the map, I imagine. He brought a lot of...
But what's it mean to get your own frequency?
Well, I don't know. They said that they named some new channel, radio, some new band in the radio frequency band that I haven't even heard of before. That now Oprah Winfrey is jumping onto, and she's creating a new radio network. But I guess you have to have special tuners or something to pick this stuff up.
Okay, so back to you have album rock. Coming in the late 60s, early 70s, and that's where the bands played longer. And the disco and punk was a reaction to that.
Mm-hmm.
You follow?
Yeah.
And so I'm saying that period of long album, long solos, and guitar heroes, is the period where people are laid out on their Quaaludes and drugs and stoned and just sort of hallucinating.
Woodstock.
Yeah, but it comes after Woodstock. Woodstock's the beginning of it, but it really develops for a few years. And that period, that's the, it's sort of like the satellite floating in space.
Oh, yeah.
And then that space collapses with the digital input, and it flips out of that into short punk or dancing around the old satellite environment.
Hmm.
Okay, the point is that America's hyperkinetic, and all these dance changes, I mean, do you know
what... Always has been since the beginning of the Industrial Age.
Because it's a kinetic culture.
Yeah.
Okay, but the electric environment speeds it up, and so there's like panic in kinetic space. So it's always improvising new dances. Do you know of any dances going on in Europe over the 20th century with rapidity and styles?
I don't know.
You can't think of any.
Yeah.
I mean, you go to France, they probably do rock. You know, they do American stuff. But if they have their cultural dance, whatever they do there, or in Germany, I mean, I haven't been part of that culture in decades, so I haven't been checking it out, but they had discos in Europe. There was always discos in the 70s and 80s. So,
well, you know, the big thing that took off there, probably bigger than the U.S., was that the goth scene.
Well, that took off from the U.S.?
No, it's probably bigger. It's in the U.S., but it's probably bigger in Europe. The gothic.
Yeah, but that's the 90s.
Oh, really?
Yeah, goth in America is 90s, and I'm assuming it's the same in Europe.
So I heard this woman on the radio the other day. She's a vampire, you know. There's these different people that fall into categories of vampire, not in the traditional sense we think of Bela Lugosi, but either because they're energy psychic vampires or because they actually are into drinking each other's blood or whatever. They're so identified with the whole goth thing. So, and I think that, I don't know if that came out of heavy metal, but I think it has some pretty deep roots in Europe.
Goth.
Yeah.
But that's a long time ago, and the, rap is interesting. I've got different statements about rap, but
rap is the street beat. It's the beat of the street, and you know.
No, it's quadrophenia. It's hip-hopping. Hip-hopping with a verbal. It's like music, and it comes back, but it's a hip-hopping, rhyming, speeded-up situation, and you're bouncing around with different postures. So I said it. I've said that the. Hip hop is the Android meme replaying all the history of dances. It's a holopathic replay of the whole electrified musical culture of America, but emphasizing the mouth and body language. So it's kind of dancing, but it's confrontational. Like the digital environment creates voluntary ESP, so you're confrontational with the mass cloned ESP world.
Well, what was the first dance movement in the U.S.? They probably brought, like, the waltz over from Europe.
Yeah.
Rap doesn't really encompass that kind of dancing at all. It doesn't wrap that up.
No, that's not electrified music.
Oh, okay.
It's electrified
right.
20th century American culture.
Yeah.
Which is hyper-kinetic space.
Yeah.
So the thing is, McLuhan did say this. We're still talking McLuhan here. I'm developing it from McLuhan. He said that dances is the main American art form because of kinetic culture. So why did we get into this? Back to this quote.
Well, back to this quote. So it is this fragmentation that enables Western man to ignore cause and effect in all interplay of technology and culture. Well, we know Western man is definitely into cause and effect, but he's saying that he's not noticing cause and effect with respect to the interplay of technology and culture.
Yeah, the environment.
And then the thing that stumped me here is that he says it's quite different with big business, because I think of big business as just simply being an extension of Western man. So why is he saying big business is more tribal?
Okay. Now this relates to what I'm saying. Once you move into the electric tactile space of the 20th century, you know, from the telegraph on, but it gets prominent with radio, then television, and then the tactile interplay of all the media inside the satellite. The kinetic industrial ground of the United States is not there anymore. So you have hyper-kinetic, speeded-up panic kinetic space, and that's all the dancing, responding to the different technological tactile media. So you have, in big business, you have international, this is like since radio, you have American corporations going international. You ever heard of the Rockefellers? Anyways, or the IMF, the World Bank, and Bretton Woods, the conspiracy. That is the global radio environment allowing American business to go international. And they're tribal. And how are they? And what do tribal people do? They're very aware of effects of any new innovations. Ever listen to guys like Art Bell, Sherman Scholl, could talk about every automobile alternative energy been suppressed by the Rockefellers?
Mm-hmm.
That's tribal man suppressing any new innovations in the technologies that have already been established and created a collective tribal man. So big business is not American.
Mm.
Big business creates environments, and those environments are tactile, and they create a tribal effect where you're going to have media quality. That's what tetrad management means, making sure nothing new gets in, or if it is new, you bring it in under full control.
Mm-hmm.
So that you're thinking of big business as American, aren't you?
Well, Western man.
Yeah, Western man, no. I mean, you go back to Spengler's book, The Decline and Fall of the West, in the 20s. I mean, the West has been in crisis as a coherent culture since the radio era. And for people to question whether the West is a viable dynamic anymore, means you've moved into a new zone. Mm-hmm. You become discarnate. Big business is internationalism. It's discarnate. It's the global village, tribal man. Mm. It's not Western. Came out of the West, but the environments that it created killed the West. And so you had the destruction of Europe in World War II.
Well, it's not North, South, East, or Western. It transcends those distinctions.
Right, right. And so then you have Western man gets infatuated with studying tribal man and the growth of anthropology, which was a big science in before World War II and up till 1960, say. But then, as McLuhan said, media studies took over from anthropology.
Oh. Hmm.
So this is a good quote. Tribal man is on the alert for stray seeds of change. So I stuck that quote in there to show how McLuhan is going to outdo tribal man by being even more ecological than big business thinks it is.
Mm-hmm.
So then we come to the big quote, which is on page 267 of Understanding Media, the next quote, where he lays it out.
In the future, the only effective media controls must take the thermostatic form of quantitative rationing. Just as we now try to control atomic bomb fallout, so we will one day try to control media fallout. Education will become recognized as civil defense against media fallout. The only medium for which our education now offers some civil defense is the print medium. The educational establishment, founded on print, does not yet admit any other responsibilities.
Note that the only medium for which our education now offers some civil defense is the print medium. In other words, that's a satirical statement. He's saying the only medium that's being boycotted is print because the kids don't live in a print-exclusive environment.
Mm-hmm.
Or, you can mean that, or I'm just thinking he also can say that because education is based on literacy and you study literacy, then you're supposed to learn and develop an ecological relationship to print. He may mean that, but just sticking out, the only medium for which our education now offers some civil defense is the print medium. I was thinking of civil defense against the print medium. But if he's saying just studying print, studying its grammars, then that's a primitive kind of civil defense. But McLuhan used to say we need new grammars for new media, not just grammar for print.
So let's go back to the first sentence. In the future, the only effective media controls must take the thermostatic form of quantitative rationing.
Yeah, like the old thing he says in Playboy magazine, if there's lots of turmoil, some kind of whatever, social turmoil going on in Venezuela, you say, okay, what medium is happening? And you look and say, it's a radio environment. Okay, we'll turn off the radio, ration the radio, and just give them newspapers or give them TV. TV will cool out the culture, whereas radio heats up a culture like it did in Europe, leading to World War II. So that's like a thermostat. Turn the temperature down or warmer or cooler, right?
Mm-hmm.
So depending on which media mix you have, you're moving into a warm or cool atmosphere.
I like this comparison here where he's comparing atomic bomb fallout to media fallout.
Yeah. So we try to police the distribution of the materials to make atom bombs, we will realize that media environments are even more destructive than the atomic bomb in terms of how they affect previous cultural matrices, and then we would build them.
Mm-hmm.
The only medium for which our education now offers some civil defense is the print medium. In other words, it's the only medium that we're educated on. Nobody educated at the time he was writing this in the 50s, early 60s, nobody educated on the grammars of television, radio, movies,
right,
automobiles. So there was no civil defense for those mediums.
Yeah.
And then the educational establishment, founded on print, does not yet admit any other responsibilities. So that's pretty straightforward.
Mm-hmm.
Let's see what he says next about all that. Okay, we're now moved over to page 35 of my book and continuing the McLuhan column. What's the quote?
For lack of observing so central an aspect of the TV image, the critics of the program, quote, content, have talked nonsense about, quote, TV violence. spokesmen of censorious views are typical semi-literate, book-oriented individuals who have no competence in the grammars of newspaper or radio or film, but who look askew and askance at all non-book media. The simplest question about any psychic aspect, even the book medium, throws these people into a panic of uncertainty. Vehemence of projection of a single isolated attitude, they make for moral vigilance. Once these censors became aware that in all cases, quote, the medium is the message or the basic source of effects, they would turn to suppression of media as such instead of seeking, quote, content control. The current assumptions that content or programming is the factor that influences outlook and action is derived from the book medium with its sharp cleavage between form and content.
And that's from page 274 of Understanding Media, and the previous quote was page 267. So, we've just had the quote where he says, in the future, the only effective media controls must take the thermostatic form of quantitative rationing. Just as we now try to control atom bomb fallout, so we will one day try to control media fallout. Education will become recognized as civil defense against media fallout. The only medium for which our education now offers some civil defense is the print medium. The educational establishment founded on print does not yet admit any other responsibility. Now, this quote you just read, Scott, the core point of McLuhan that people sort of understood, that he was stressing the form, not the content. But the subtleties of that, the implications of that, requires all the other writing he did. But the very end where it says, the book culture has a sharp cleavage between form and content. Other cultures don't have that. So when you have a sharp cleavage between form and content, you're then going to emphasize either form and content. And as McLuhan said, because speech is the content of the printed word, we think the content is more important. All right? Literate people get fooled that content is the controlling influence and the role of form. So the average literate society has no awareness of form the way the tribal societies do. And the tribal societies have better awareness of form because it's not so separated from content. So we talk about the Cartesian split of the mind, the mind-body split. Well, there's the form-content split in the environment around us besides what's in our bodies, both effects of literacy. You see what I'm saying?
You mean the distinction between the form of the alphabet, the grammar, and so on, and as distinct from the content that it's communicating, the ideas?
Yeah,
I still have a hard time with that one. It seems to me the content is at least as significant as the form. You're communicating. How else do you communicate ideas?
I do by speech. But here's the thing. Ideas themselves are a product of literacy. This is what Plato came up with. Ideas and archetypal. As they moved into visual space, they split off form from content and came up with and romanticized, archetypalized, the notion of ideas. And ideas was this separate abstract effect of the phonetic alphabet. Remember, the phonetic alphabet is meaningless signs and symbols, signs and letters. They don't look like what they represent. We've been through this before, right?
Right.
And that split, when someone dances something to you, you get the effect. May not be any ideas in there, or you get the meaning, but you would not get, you wouldn't be able to categorize it into ideas.
Well, just like someone who doesn't speak English, if they were listening to our conversation right now, they would not be able to categorize it into ideas.
That's because they're listening. They could respond to the emotions. And they wouldn't.
If I try to read Hebrew, I cannot categorize it into ideas. So I don't understand. I don't know what it's saying.
Right. But it's the act of reading that evokes that there are ideas to be communicated.
Mm-hmm.
When you're in a pre-literate speech society, there are no ideas or concepts. They're just percepts. There's just involvement and response.
Yeah. Ideas like a tool. Somebody in a tribal situation gets an idea that works. They use it like a tool to take advantage of everybody else.
but they don't. You can't propagate. You can't use propaganda on pre-litter people.
Mm.
Not propagated to pre-litter people. It's only in the. This is a major McLuhan idea. A notion, as he said, only littered people can be propagandized.
Wow.
Cause there's a wow?
Yeah, because they're hypnotized by visual space, I guess.
Right, and you just think of
You still have a certain kind of, maybe this doesn't qualify as propaganda, but within the tribe you have the pecking order gets established. You have the, usually there's somebody who becomes the tribal leader.
Well, there's different phases. In early tribes, they didn't have a pecking order based on whatever it was based on. Before that, it was based on people's skills. When you went hunting, the guy who could run the fastest or shoot, throw an arrow, whatever, a spear the fastest, he would guide the tribe.
Mm-hmm.
When they stopped the hunting and went back to the cooking, some other person, maybe the women would take over. Then when you celebrated the cooking and had a dance, then those that had the musical ability would take over. So it was flexible.
Yeah.
It's only when you start to get into agricultural societies that you get into storage, and then the women run that in agriculture, and then the men are there to protect you. So then you get priest and soldier society.
Mm-hmm.
So the men role becomes solidified, right?
Right.
William Irwin Thompson goes, we'll get to him.
Yeah.
And then once you have the cities, you know, extreme agricultural development of cities, and then there's a hierarchy. So we don't live in cities anymore in that sense. We live in discarnate states. So we retrieve pre-literate modalities and lifestyles, which is basically nomadism, as people do their information hunting. And information hunting is just tuning in the radio. It doesn't mean ideas. It means engaging with sensory data that comes through the electric media.
Mm-hmm.
So if you thought, if you lived inside a drum, as Zappa says on Lumpy Gravy, you know, it's just something like drums are noisy. When you live inside a drum, I forget what it was. Anyways, the idea of living inside a drum is what happens when the radio environment comes in. Have that, I think the line from Lumpy Gravy was, drums are noisy. Do you remember it? Maybe you don't know.
No, but, you know, I never quite, I mean, I sort of went along with the idea of the, you know, the radio environment as in relation to beating the tribal drum. But I'm not sure I really get the
right, because here's the point. When you have simultaneous communication, simultaneous electric environment, which came in with the telegraph, but really increased with the radio, because telegraph was simultaneous but point to point. Now everybody's inside the radio environment in the 20s and 30s. You're inside an echo chamber, which is like living inside a drum.
Mm-hmm.
And that is not just sit and listening to radio. All the other media must adapt to the pace that the radio society brings in.
Mm-hmm.
And so that led to the militarization of Europe, Germany and Italy first, because they were the most least industrialized cultures, least visual space. They were within visual space. They had visual space ideas, but they weren't as industrialized as France, England, and the United States. The point is that...
Well, I get the idea of living inside the drum or the echo chamber. That kind of gives me a sense of living inside the radio environment, but the rhythm of the beating of the tribal drum, I mean, what rhythm is there to radio that creates that sort of tribal... You know, that tribal energy, which is heating up the tribe and getting people dancing and prepared for warfare or whatever they're doing.
Okay, no, you're mistaking what you hear on the radio for the radio environment.
Mm-hmm.
The tribal drum is hard to get if you think it's radio is just what you hear. It's the implosion into the one electrified membrane zone. Remember, the global village is a membrane. It's like one spot.
Mm-hmm.
Because everybody's inside it, all the previous media and cultures.
Right.
And so that is the psychic pressure.
Mm.
And so then you use sound as your content metaphor to explain it. So you say you're living in a drum. But the actual radio environment is total silence. But it's implosion. I mean, if I turn on the radio and there's no content, I can hear the static, and I can perceive that millions of other people can hear the static or hear the dead space. And what is hearing it? My brain is inside that thing, and I'm inside it, and it's inside me. That's the implosion.
Yeah.
And you have to perceive that.
Well, it's the fact that it's not that it's inside you and you're inside it. It's the fact that it's ubiquitous. Everything is inside you and you're inside of it. You know, your brain is not.
No, you're moving.
Your brain has no contact with what's out there.
Anything you say about the brain is an idea. I'm not talking about that dish over there in the stove. That's not inside my brain. It could be argued when you get into analyzing ideas of perception. But radio is not an idea. It's an environment. It's like the weather.
Mm-hmm.
The weather is what's affecting me.
Mm-hmm.
You know, and you can't go into concepts about the idea everything's in your brain or everything's not in your brain. Those are speculations based on an idea of a brain. But the fact that everybody can hear and engage in the same space, that is what Teilhard de Chardin said, the biological event that we went into, the new sea.
Mm-hmm.
You see, it's electricity itself.
Yeah, it's like the atmosphere.
Yeah, now some people say, well, how does that translate into social fact? It translates into social fact is that it disrupts previous societies based on previous media. That's the social fact. It's the effect of the technology on the previous cultures.
Mm-hmm.
And then you have the telephone.
And so, because it's ubiquitous, it's affecting all cultures everywhere.
Yes, and then...
And this is even harder for me to get, but, you know... Marshall, or you might say that, you know, when a telegraph, even though it was, you know, communicating around the United States and Europe and different countries, you know, it was affected, you know, the guys down in the Amazon who never saw or heard of anything such as a telegraph. I mean,
right. It speeded up mobility. Now, this is where big business comes in. You have the kinetic industrial culture of money. They can start moving money all over the planet rapidly.
Right.
And in the content of the news on the radio speeds up people's interpretation of what's going on.
Yeah.
So
the days of Homer, the only way to move wealth around was to put it on a cart.
Yeah, and, or a boat.
Yeah, and physically transport it, you know, at, you know, snail's pace.
So that big business is tribal man, and tribal man is the content of discarnate 20th century man. Since humans can't deal with the imploded effect, their culture adapts to it. The older media, so bankers went international. That's where Hitler went nuts on the Jewish conspiracy. They projected a global control of money.
Yeah.
And that was the effect of radio on an old medium of money. And, of course, with airplanes and radio and telephones, people and cars, people could move around the planet pretty quickly.
Mm.
And so it became a global village.
Mm.
And that led to a retrieved tribal image of ourselves, but we were not, that was the content. The form was, we were not here anymore.
I wonder if, it, you know, part of the propaganda against going about the, against the Jews was that they were becoming instrumental in banking, in the banking industry. I wonder if Hitler thought the Jews were actually a threat, in the sense that he believed that they might take over the world banking system, and so he became in competition with them.
Yeah, well, he wrote that, whether he believed it or not, depends on how much you think he was cynical, but he knew that there would be a market for it. One of the problems, the reason that the Jews got in trouble in Germany is that the implosive effect of the radio, that creates a psychic pressure on the white Germans, so they look around at who is the cause of this problem that they feel, just like McCarthyism was an effect of television, and they thought it was communists. Anyways, the Germans looked around, and what rises up? A tribal culture. The Jews. They were a tribal culture in Europe, isolated band, and they stood up as a figure. They were hooked up being tribal by the tribal effect.
Mm-hmm.
Now, let's check the time.
Okay, we got 2 minutes left on this tape.
So we should end at that point.
Yeah.
Let's see if there's another thing to say before the tape runs out.
Well, there's a lot to say about this next paragraph, beginning with the word "for lack of observing so central an aspect of the TV image, the critics of program content have talked nonsense about TV violence." He's saying that this whole argument about whether violent content on TV is a moot point, practically. But
yes, because TV as a medium itself causes more violence on the older media.
Yeah, but still, nobody wants to expose their kids to just all kinds of violence on content on TV. So it's not a non-issue.
No, it is, because nobody stopped. This is 40 years ago. Nobody stopped. We have nothing but violence on TV. That's what the kids take in. They don't take it. They just make sure there's no sex on there.
Yeah.
No, TV is, ridiculously violent.
Yeah, it is.
And the kids aren't protected from that, because it is a moot point. It's not the real violence. The real violence is the effect of TV turning previous media cultures into stone and unable to notice what's going on.
Why hasn't sexual content been allowed to proliferate on TV? What's so threatening about that?